On this week's 51%, we speak with journalist and author Pagan Kennedy about her new book, The Secret History of the Rape Kit, tracking the life and work of the woman behind the crime reporting tool, Martha Goddard.
Just the collection of the evidence and having these kits, it's a message that says every person has the right to report sexual assault, have their evidence stored and treated seriously, and be taken seriously.
I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. 50 years ago, the crime of sexual assault was treated a lot differently than it is today. Some things surely haven't changed, but back in the 1970s, there was no reliable, real way for survivors to present forensic evidence of the crime in court. The forensic exams or rape kits that hospitals and police departments conduct with survivors today is thanks to, in large part, a woman named Martha Goddard. If you Google Goddard, however, you won't find much information about her. Our main guest today has spent years trying to find Goddard and learn more about her life. Pagan Kennedy is a journalist and columnist who has written for the New York Times, Boston Globe Magazine, Ms. Magazine, and The New Yorker. She's also the author of 12 books, her latest being her book about Goddard, called The Secret History of the Rape Kit, a true crime story. Kennedy says she first started seriously researching rape kits in 2018, when multiple news outlets reported a backlog of kits that had gone unprocessed across the U.S. Thinking about it, Kennedy found herself kind of amazed by the invention. To paraphrase her words, it's kind of a feminist miracle. There's so many inventions that enable sexual assault, either deliberately or not, and not many that actually fight it. Kennedy searched for the creator on Wikipedia, and the name that popped up was not Goddard, but a man, a Chicago police sergeant named Louis Fatullo, who died in 2006. Buried a little further in the article was the name of the woman who proposed the idea of the kit to Fatullo, Martha Goddard. Kennedy dove into research on Goddard, who she calls by her nickname Marty, as well as her friends and colleagues. Just a heads up that today's conversation focuses on sexual assault, which can be triggering for some listeners. And if you or someone you love has been impacted by sexual abuse, please know help is available. RAIN's National Sexual Assault Hotline is open 24/7 at 1-800-656-4673. But here's Pagan Kennedy, I'm Martha Goddard, and the secret history of the rape kit.
So for her, it began, she was working in a philanthropical organization in the early 1970s. She was a divorcee, loved living in the city, you know, kind of that early 70s woman who was very career-oriented. And as part of her job, she volunteered at what was then called like a hotline for runaway teenagers. They would call them runaways in the early 70s. I mean, now we might call them trafficked children or abused children. But anyway, so she was taking these calls from kids who were living on the street. And what she began to notice was, especially with the girls, many, many, many of them were running away from abusive families, specifically sexual abuse. And part of understanding this story and understanding how big this revelation was, I think you need to understand that 50 years ago, things were so different. First of all, marital rape was legal across the country. So a husband had the right to do whatever he wanted to his wife's body. There was very little awareness of child abuse or child sexual assault. That was thought to be very, very rare. And I mean, when I was researching this time period, I turned up the most, it was just shocking to see how the media portrayed child abuse and sexual assault. I found this article in the New York Times called Little Ladies of the Night, and it talked about the problem of 13 and 12, 13, 14-year-old girls in Midtown Manhattan turning tricks, being prostitutes, as they were called then. I mean, you know, we would now call that children being trafficked, but And it was everything was blamed on these 13-year-old girls that they were sort of ruining. They were bringing crime to Midtown Manhattan. It just was so strange. There was no focus on the men who were trafficking them, or the sense of who was the criminal and who was the victim was so backwards from the way we see it today. And actually, just recently, while I just turned up these crazy sort of instructional videos for women and girls about supposedly how not to get raped, and you were supposed to like fend off the attacker with like hat pins in your purse. You were completely responsible. It was just like you are on your own to physically fight off any attacker, and it's if you don't, it's sort of your fault.
I mean, if you were assaulted, what were your options back then? If you wanted to report, how would police even handle it?
The way the police departments generally would treat sexual assault at that time was, I mean, I found this, there's like a training manual you can see from 1973 in the Chicago Police Department. And it said, many or most of the women who come forward are just liars. They're just jealous women who are trying to get their boyfriends in trouble or something like that. So there was, the idea was like you could not prove that sexual assault happened. It would be impossible. It was an unprovable crime. And generally, many, many of the survivors were supposed to be liars. And it was up to the discretion of the police officer to decide how he felt about the victim and whether he would take her story seriously.
Jeez, yeah. So how did the rape kit get its start? And it sounds like you were kind of finding it out as you went.
Marty Goddard and working closely with this friend and an associate of hers, Cynthia Gary, came up with the idea that we need evidence. We need good evidence. And even when the police departments did collect evidence, it was often thrown out because there was no rigorous system. She began to realize, oh, we need a system here where the medical workers are trained to work with the crime labs, and they all kind of speak the same language. And her idea was a kit. And a very important piece of this was that, everybody who touched the kit would sign off on it. So there would be accountability. You couldn't just throw out the evidence. I should say that I have since discovered, doing deep research for the book, this was generally talked about as the Chicago kit that was developed by Vitullo and Marty Goddard was often spoken about as the first kit and the first system, but they were not the first. There were little experiments around the country that never really took off, but there were local experiments. So there were other kits bubbling up here and there, so that, they may have borrowed from other places. It's hard to know. But generally, what was really significant was the ambition and scope. Anyway, so sometime in the mid-70s, Marty Goddard, and I know I should say that I was still looking for months, I was still looking for Marty Goddard, talking to people who knew her at the time. Nobody knew what had happened to her. But a big breakthrough for me was finding Cynthia Gary, who had been the woman who had collaborated with her in the early 70s. And Cynthia was investigating police violence and was working on that and was very knowledgeable about how the police in Chicago. And so I did manage to find Cynthia. And, when we talked on the phone the first time, the minute we started talking, she said, "I have to tell you what happened when Marty Goddard brought her idea to Louis Vitullo." I remember this because Marty called me right afterwards. She called me up and she said she brought in this idea about a rape kit and a system, and Vitullo threw her out of his office.
Oh,
And
wow.
she had joked, "Well, that didn't go very well. I thought I would work with the crime lab. I thought this was a great idea, but this guy just threw me out." And now, this is Cynthia's version. I don't have Vitullo has, was dead by the time I began doing this research. So I don't have his version except for, sort of what was in his obituary or whatever, which is not very detailed. But anyway, there, Cynthia's version was, I remember that. And then I remember that a few days later, he called Marty back into his office and he had worked out a prototype of the kit that she had described. But then she really took it from there. She formed a nonprofit group, and it was going to require a lot of money because she wanted this to be in every hospital, in Chicago in the beginning. And everybody had to be trained. And, there was just like huge amounts of money that had to be spent on training, but she also had to manufacture the actual kits. And so this is where, I mean, there's so many turns and places where I turned a corner in the story and things just were so crazy. And one of them was she couldn't find any funding from any of the usual organizations that would fund public health or something like that, because nobody wanted to touch this. This was very controversial. So in the end, she worked with a friend of hers who was then named Margaret Standish, is now named Margaret McCourney, at the Playboy Foundation. Hugh Hefner, he actually gave a lot of money to anything that would advance women's sexual freedom. So abortion, he helped Ruth Bader Ginsburg get going. He worked for, supported feminist causes. And so the Playboy Foundation did give the initial seed money to create the first kits. And in fact, apparently the Playboy magazine graphics designers helped design the original kit, which is this cardboard box with a very 70s looking cartoon of a woman in profile on it, but also very official looking because, it had to really not just be a scientific kit, but it had to be something that would be brought into the courtroom and look official, to people.
Well, on that note, I'd like to talk a little bit about how that system and the kit works and what's included in it.
Yeah, so that's a great question. It was developed before the invention of DNA fingerprinting. So it was developed at a time when, if you collected swabs of biological material like blood or semen, you could know somebody's blood type. You could maybe, they might have some kind of biomarker that would narrow down things down a lot, but you couldn't know a lot about them. It wasn't, once DNA fingerprinting was invented in the late 1980s, and then of course you could, with a lot of certainty, you could connect, say a blood sample to one particular human. The actual kit contained a lot of envelopes for swabs and hair and any other thing that you might find, any kind of physical evidence, as well as the clothing of the victim, which might also contain semen or something, but might also show signs of violence, like stab marks. And then also there were sheets where you could record in detail all the damage that had done to the survivor's body. So bruise marks or stab marks or any signs of violence. And that was very important at the time, of course, when you didn't have DNA fingerprinting, to have this rigorous 5 or 6 hour exam where you would document every single thing you saw on this person's body and also collect her story so that when she went into court, somebody in a lab coat could say, look, this is what we found, and here's pictures of the bruises or, all the things that could support the story. What's kind of weird is that the kit hasn't really changed a lot. It looks a lot now as it did in the 70s, so it might contain a lot of envelopes for different samples, biological samples, swabs. I should also say that it varies state by state, like each state has a different version of this, but they tend to all be like this. And they haven't changed that much since the 70s, even though a lot of technology has advanced. What's really amazing was they did do all of this rigorous collection of biological samples in the 70s and early 80s before they had DNA fingerprinting. But because people had been collecting all this evidence, you have this treasure trove of biological data that now can be tested. And the DNA actually can last a pretty, if it's stored correctly, can last a pretty long time, many decades sometimes. So what Marty Goddard and the other activists at that time built was this amazing system of data collection. When it's working correctly and when it's funded and when it's allowed to work and when the kits aren't thrown away, this is just an amazing invention because at the same time that you can show, say, the path of a predator from state to state, you could also show, a lot of times when exonerations happen of innocent men, the DNA comes from a rape kit. But I think also what's really important is that they created a new sense of norms around sexual assault. And just the collection of the evidence and having these kits, it's a message that says every person has the right to report sexual assault, give their evidence, have their evidence stored and treated seriously, and be taken seriously.
I guess, how do you feel that maybe we can make the most of the system we have today, or, even make it better? Because for years now, there's been reports about backlogs in the rape kit system where kits just go unexamined or sitting at the wayside or missing. Are there ways that we can build on Marty's work or make it more accessible to people?
That's a great question, and I'm glad you mentioned accessibility because I think most people are aware of the backlog. And because of wonderful survivor groups and wonderful prosecutors and activists and just so many people who worked on the backlog problem, that is less of a problem now. So much of the backlog has been whittled down, and that we have all this amazing new data coming out of those old rape kits and cold cases. But I think the problem that's a lot less talked about is accessibility, because again, it varies state by state, but generally you would have to drive to a hospital if you don't live, in walking distance of a hospital that participates in the system. And you might have to wait 8, 10 hours, who knows, before you see the nurse. Who will handle the kit. And then this, again, it's still a very similar exam to the 1970s. So it can last 5 or 6 hours. It's very, very rigorous. And that's wonderful. But it also means that the burden placed on the survivor is very high. I mean, so if you don't have a car, if you are a mom with small kids and you don't have childcare, if you are rural, if you're, this is far less accessible to women of color who may not feel safe going into these, may not be able to find a nurse examiner who looks like her, or people of color, trans people, there's just a lot of people who can't easily get access to this system or who may find it really traumatizing and not want to go through this enormous process, which is, if you think about it, it's such a gift from any survivor to all of us to submit evidence because they're really worried about the next person who might be attacked. It's something they give us. So I don't have the solution to this, but I think we really need a big conversation about how to make the kit more accessible and what survivors want and what different communities, say indigenous communities or communities of color, what kind of system would work for them, how we can just make this way more comfortable. There's little experiments happening. There's I think different nurses have vans where they go to the survivor, which is like a great idea, but I don't have the answer because I think the answer should come from the survivors themselves as well as the forensic nurses and, police departments and everybody who works on this really needs to talk about how we can make this way more accessible because if we could, it would be amazing. I think the lesson of what's happened to Roe versus Wade should be taken as a lesson to what could happen to our sexual assault evidence system. I mean, it can be taken away and those norms can change. And I really worry there is a bill that just passed in Idaho that requires all minors, all people under 18, to get parental approval before any medical procedure, including filing a rape kit. And so that would mean if the parents or the family members are the actual perpetrators, and that makes it pretty much impossible for them to file a kit. So that's already, you can see like the norms are being eaten away, that there could be rollbacks of this fundamental. I mean, while I was working on this book, I didn't even question any idea that we all agree that every survivor of child abuse or sexual assault should be able to submit evidence freely and fairly. And, if their own parent can't be trusted, there should be something in place where they can help have a friend help them report, or a teacher or somebody they trust. And, I worry that that can be rolled back. And, I really think that we need to come together right now to talk about how to make the system way more resilient.
We're speaking with Pagan Kennedy, author of The Secret History of the Rape Kit. If it's all right, I kind of want to go back to Marty a little bit. I'm curious, what made Marty the person who was able to make this kit happen? Because as you mentioned, this was a really controversial idea in the 1970s. And, Marty was potentially thrown out of her first meeting with Louis Fatillo. But how, I guess, was she ultimately able to get into those meetings in the first place? And is there anything about her activism that we can take into today?
Yeah, that's a great question. At a personal level of what fired her up, that was one of the mystery stories for me. That was, and I won't spoil it. I found out a lot about her own life and her childhood and so forth. I eventually was able to speak with her sister. But in terms of her personal style, she was really that, if you picture her, I asked Cynthia, describe what Marty would have looked like in the early 70s. What was she wearing? And, her whole vibe, and so she was really that kind of early 70s woman with, she had short blonde hair and this new divorcee, like marriage just wasn't for her. And she would go to, restaurants and bars and everything with her briefcase and have meetings all the time. She was working for, a philanthropic organization, and they gave her quite a lot of leeway to kind of just figure out what kind of programs they should support and all of that. So she was running around having meetings, and she was very loved being this person who was in the mix and was able to get things done. And so she was not a fan of the more radical feminists who were like protesting outside of the police departments and calling the police pigs and all of that. She was all for kind of showing up with her briefcase and saying, "Hey, look, I think I've analyzed the problem and I think I have a solution for you." So, but at the same time, I'd like to say that the more radical women opened the way for her, because this is the time period where the first women are graduating from law school. There was this group called CLAW. It was a group of women who were, many of them trained lawyers, who were protesting just the epidemic of rape in Chicago and making rape illegal in a way that it wasn't. And by the mid-70s in Chicago, there was a task force on sexual assault, and Marty was heading up the citizens branch of that. And so that gave her the kind of imprimatur, that she needed to get into the police departments and hospitals. But she really loved talking to everybody, analyzing. She had these deep conversations with, say, people in the crime lab about why they would throw out packages that were sent to them by the medical people who had, even before the rape kit, the medical examiners or nurses would look at a sexual assault, a survivor, and try to collect evidence, but they weren't trained, so they didn't collect good evidence. And so the crime lab would often, told Marty that they would, "Well, we'd throw this away because these stupid, nurses don't know how to collect a slide, and then it's all damaged once it gets to us." So the obvious thought was, "Well, let's train the, nurses and medical staff to work with the crime lab and to know how to collect evidence and not, The nurses obviously were much more oriented towards just giving the survivor care. So they might just rip their clothes apart in their haste to, if the victim had been stabbed or something, the patient, they were just trying to help the patient, but they didn't realize that that was really important evidence. But she also, in her research, she found just such disregard for the survivors that the police, that there were no clothes. I mean, this is sometimes a problem still, but there were no clothes kept for the survivors who came into the hospital after an attack, and their clothes would be confiscated as evidence. And then they'd just be sent home in like a paper hospital Johnny in a police car, basically naked with all their neighbors able to see. You know, there's just like a deep humiliation that happens to the survivors, and we have to change that culture. So it was also about really making a survivor-focused evidence system, really thinking about it from the point of view of the survivor.
Well, Pagan, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. If it's too much of a spoiler, then no worries, but I'm wondering what ended up happening to Marty. Were you ever able to find her?
That I'm not going to spoil, but I will say it took me a very long time to find out. And I've reported a lot of stories. I'm quite ancient at this point in my life. I've done a lot of journalism work. And this was one of those stories where every corner you turn, there's just something you didn't expect. And I found out so many things about Marty from the people who knew her, and including this crazy twist when I was interviewing Margaret Corney, who had worked with her in the Playboy Foundation, who knew Marty quite well, and revealed that Marty had been an obsessive maker of dollhouse scenes, or these miniatures. And that kind of opened up a whole other side of her character that I was completely fascinated with. And so subsequently, every time I then found another person who knew her, I'd say, tell me about the dollhouses. And I learned so much more about her inner life and her, sort of the world she inhabited and who she was through this hobby of hers that in interesting ways really intersected with forensic science. So it was quite a lot of discoveries along the way, but I don't want to reveal too much about all of that.
That's okay. That's okay. I'm glad you were able to at least find so much information on her and kind of like bring her story to light, because I mean, you say it early in the book, but like when you look up the inventor of the rape kit, the first name is often Louis Vittillo, which, not to discredit his contribution, he did develop that first kit. But part of me thought while reading that, like, God, isn't that typical? So I'm happy you were able to tell Martha's story and just, highlight her work.
Thank you so much.
Pagan Kennedy is a journalist and author of 12 books, her latest being The Secret History of the Rape Kit, a true crime story. It's out now through Vintage Books, and you can find it at most major booksellers. If you or someone you love has been impacted by sexual assault, please know help is available. RAIN's National Sexual Assault Hotline is open 24/7 at 1-800-656-4673 and online at online.rainn.org. Thanks for joining us for this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. You can stay in the loop on all of WAMC shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along. Night and on the hallway, I had to learn. sit on.